in the limelight.
In 2022, 15 years after the Zionist regime intensified its siege on Gaza, the conditions have only worsened, with numerous Israeli attacks destroying infrastructure, homes, and ways of life. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Riad Gadura, political analyst. This article is published under the heading, "Why Has Gaza Sea Turned Black?" Here's the story. In June 2006, the Zionist regime bombed Gaza Strip's only power plant. Since then, Palestinians have lived an average of two-thirds of those ensuing years in darkness amid a blockade the Zionist regime intensified in 2007. That comes to roughly 95,000 hours with no electricity over 16 years. These figures are calculations based on the daily electricity outage tallies uncovered by numerous surveys and reports from human rights groups. For example, the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, estimates that over 80% of Palestinians in Gaza have electricity for a meager 6 to 8 hours a day. But Salem reports that Gaza's power plant runs on a scant 180 megawatts when Gaza's population of over 2 million needs at least 600 megawatts. A main cause of the electricity shortage in Gaza is no secret. When the Zionist regime is not bombing the power plant, it is blocking the entry of the fuel needed to operate it, an action that Fadel al-Muzaini of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights says is indicative of the Zionist regime's policy of collective punishment against Palestinians. But what does it mean to be on the other end of this policy of collective punishment? To live your life in the dark? The cost of a life with no electricity is so immense that a person living outside Gaza might struggle to imagine it. And though statistics give us a grim overview, 94% of Palestinians in Gaza believe that the lack of electricity is affecting their mental health, according to that same ICRC survey. How can a person who lives an ordinary life imagine being deprived of such a basic necessity? We can start with daily life in Gaza. In Gaza, knowing the electricity distribution schedule is an essential part of organizing one's day. It is a constant in your mind, always planning when you will have electricity and when you'll be left in the dark. For example, if you live on a high floor of an apartment building, you plan your errands around the power outages. When the power comes back on, you can return home so you can use the elevator. Without power, your life is on hold, whether it's taking a hot water shower or watching television. Even inviting friends over must wait for electricity, as hot weather necessitates fans. At night, candles and solar panels are useful. Students must do their homework by candlelight or otherwise rush through assignments and take advantage of the computer and internet while there is still power. Yet, alternate electricity methods pose dangers and inconveniences. Fires caused by candles and generator explosions killed 32 people between 2010 and 2018, according to Al Mizan Center for Human Rights. And electricity generators rumble and drone loudly, sometimes emitting plumes of toxic smoke. During the sweltering heat of summer and the numbing cold of winter, the electric outages pose the biggest threat to one's state of mind and health. Being indoors during the summer is essentially unbearable. One must go outdoors to get fresh air. Yet the suffering through extreme temperatures is even greater if one belongs to a more vulnerable population, such as the ill or elderly. Khalil, 40, is unemployed and in pain much of the time. He has relied on dialysis for the past 12 years to keep his kidneys functioning. He needs 3 sessions a week at Al-Shifa Hospital, and each session lasts about 4 hours, a near impossible task for Gaza's electric grid. Though the backup generator kicks in so as not to interrupt his treatment for too long, in those moments when the power is out, Khalil's life is in peril. There is always the fear the electricity will not come back on. The Ministry of Health in the Gaza Strip says that about 820 patients in the coastal strip suffer from kidney failure. A struggling mid-40s dialysis patient named Hossam told the Electric Intifada that the dialysis machines in use at Gaza hospitals are in poor and aged condition. He attributed this to the Zionist regime's blockade limiting the import of medical equipment. The power outages only compound the difficulties of dialysis, since when the process is interrupted, it can cause blood clots. At another hospital in northern Gaza, Ahmad, aged 2, has just undergone a urethral and bladder dilation surgery. His father, Ali, says they spend at least 9 hours a day without power at the hospital. During the time of power cut, the air conditioners don't operate. He notes of the situation they face at the hospital, adding, "We suffer a lot due to the high temperature nowadays in Gaza." To cope, Ali uses paper to make a fan for his son to provide some relief to the boy while he recovers from surgery. Away from hospitals and homes, the effects of power outages can hit in unlikely places, including a day at the beach, a once blissful summer pastime and great obsession of Palestinians in Gaza. Some families stay at the beach from early morning until midnight, playing soccer and volleyball, having picnics and flying kites. Lately, however, a day at the beach is not the same. Gaza's municipalities pump sewage directly into the sea when the Zionist regime interrupts fuel shipments to the sewage treatment plant. Ahmad Hels, the chairman of the National Institute for Environment and Development, said that 120,000 cubic meters of untreated or partially treated sewage is pumped out along Gaza's shoreline every day. The seawater, as a result, can become putrid and unsuitable for swimming, black and full of gastrointestinal parasites. Children break out in rashes and contract various intestinal illnesses from the polluted water. In 2022, 15 years after the Zionist regime intensified its siege on Gaza, the conditions have only worsened, with numerous Israeli attacks destroying infrastructure, homes, and ways of life. A report issued by the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development stated that The total economic losses of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip from 2007 to 2018 amounted to about $17 billion, and the poverty rate increased to 56%. Any semblance of a normal life in Gaza is undermined by this diminished economy, but its faltering electrical grid and the daily power outages are a reminder of how these statistics are not so abstract. Midstream.
Love and beauty in times of war. Prayer, friendship, priesthood, and the church in times of adversity. Syria, its role and future, and the horizon of faith in a contemporary world governed by the empire and its tools. Father Elias Zahlawi, a Catholic priest of the Church of Our Lady of Damascus, speaks to us about the initiation of Zionism in our region and its plans to ruin the East as per his many published books, namely War and Peace in Syria, which he published in 2020. We will touch upon Father Zahlawi's positive stances on Hezbollah, for instance, which raised a lot of Western eyebrows, the same West that allowed and facilitated the brutal attack of Syria and is still actively occupying Syrian land and looting Syria's natural resources. Thank you, Father Zahlawi, for allowing us to show the world the Christianity of Syria. This report introduces to our audience Father Elias Zahlawi, the dignified priest whom the demons of this earth could not seduce. During tough times, he brought delight to the hearts of people around him with his joy choir. His beloved country's pain made him insist on exposing colonialism, Zionism, and terrorism while standing firm beside both Christians and Muslims who defended Syria and would sacrifice their own to defend Palestine. More details in this following report.
Elias Zahlawi was born in Damascus in 1932. He attended the Melkite Greek Catholic Seminary of St. Anne in Al-Quds, Palestine, where he studied philosophy and theology when the old city was still free and not under Zionist occupation. Zahlawi was ordained a priest in July 1959. In 1962, Zahlawi moved back to Damascus, where he was responsible for church youth work at the university from 1968. When the Melkite Church of Our Lady of Damascus was completed in 1975, Zahlawi became one of her three priests who served at the church. He was responsible for youth work and church music. In 1977, Father Zahlawi, along with 50 children, founded the Chorus of Joy, which made its first appearance at a church service on December 24, 1977. The choir became one of the most famous and popular in Syria and grew to 500 members between the ages of 7 and 70 from different Christian churches of different denominations in Damascus by 2010. From 1975 to 1980, Elias Zahlawi taught Latin and translations at the University of Damascus, and from 1978 to 1979, theater history at the College of Theater Arts. In 1973, he became a member of the Arab Writers Association. Father Zahlawi, who studied for several years in the Palestinian city of Al-Quds, represents positions of secular Arab nationalism and repeatedly speaks out in articles and speeches in support for the cause of the Palestinians against the Zionist occupation and aggression. When the People's Committee to Support the Intifada was founded in May 2011, he was selected as a member. When the global war against Syria erupted in 2011, Father Zahlawi took a stand in support of the government of Syria led by President Bashar al-Assad. With his speeches against Western interference and his support for the government in Syria, Father Zahlawi hits a nerve for Christians in Syria who, after the U.S. Army invaded Iraq in 2003, leading to the suffering and immigration of Christians there, increasingly feared interference by Western powers and thus a repetition of the crimes against Christians in Syria, just as happened in Iraq. Father Elias Zahlawi never ceases to underscore the necessity of unity amongst the citizens of the Syrian Arab Republic by stating that the Christ's message of peace applies to all people, both Christians and Muslims. Even after 2011, Father Elias Zahlawi organized performances of his Choir of Joy in Syria and various countries around Europe, where he repeatedly campaigned openly for a secular Syria away from Takfiri terrorism and Western intervention. In June 2017, Father Zahlawi received an award for reviews, studies, and translations presented to him by the Syrian government under the patronage of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
Father Elias Zahlawi, thanks again for being with us and allowing us this opportunity. Let us begin with you. Let us begin with your journey in life. How did your priesthood start, and why did it start in Palestine?
It is a very long story. When a child chooses to become a priest, he really does not understand what he has chosen. I was influenced by one of my relatives. When he was young, he was also a hyperactive kid, just like me. He went to Al-Quds and spent 6 years studying. When he returned, he was a completely different human. I was amazed by his new character and his new thoughts and the way he interacted with people. I became infatuated by his character and wanted so much to be like him, especially that he was a close relative. So I decided to go to Al-Quds along with 9 other kids my age. We were 12 years old back then. However, in Al-Quds and later in Lebanon, I discovered that personality of Jesus Christ and I fell in love with him. As time passed, I found out that it is worth for the sake of Jesus Christ to devote my life for him. This, of course, happened after deep thinking, a long period of studying the matter and passing through many tests in life. I also took traveling to Paris, where I stayed for a year. It also took stern encounters with my superiors. Eventually, in 1959, I became a priest, only because I loved Jesus and because I wanted, through Christ, to just love his people and serve them.
Father, you lived through the highs and the lows of Syria. Lows that were imposed on Syria by the Western intervention and by terrorist attacks on the country. How did that affect your parish in the Church of Our Lady of Damascus? And how did it also affect the theater that you guide, especially the Joy Choir, which you co-founded in Syria back in 1968? How did it all get affected?
The parish are part of the Syrian citizens. The Church of Our Lady of Damascus is part of Damascus, and Damascus is the capital of Syria. Our reaction towards the events in Syria was typically identical to the reaction of any other human who belongs to his homeland. One's homeland, after Allah, is the most precious thing in existence. Hence, we reacted accordingly, and we used to pray and think a lot. For myself, I used my time on TV interviews to preach what I believe in. I called upon the people to stand in sincerity with their homeland in the face of the entire world. This calling was an obvious and logical one. I pursued my calling and found that it was my duty to write letters for officials and leaders from around the world, to write letters for leaders of churches around the world, at the top of which is His Holiness, the Pope of Rome. I wrote my letters while fully knowing that I will never receive any replies. However, I wanted my calling to get out there. I wanted the voice of my people in Syria to be heard by a Syrian citizen whose name is Elias Zahlawi, signed by a priest from Syria, signed by a Christian from Syria, a Syrian Arab Christian. This is what I tried to do, and I am always ready to continue this effort, because that it is part of my belief and my duty towards my God and my homeland, Syria.
How did your work with the Choir of Joy bring peace to your parish in Syria?
فقدنا خمس شهداء في زوقة.
We lost five martyrs from our joy choir. One of them was a young man named Shadi Shalhoub. He was in his senior year studying to become a pharmacist. Bombs were falling like heavy rain over Damascus. Within 3 months, 3,000 artillery bombs fell over the capital, Damascus. Our Lady of Damascus Church was very close to the hottest area in Damascus, Jubar. This made it very dangerous for everyone who wanted to attend church. At that time, the choir practices took place inside the church. When things were out of control, Shadi's father asked him not to join the church so as not to be killed, while emphasizing that he will notify Father Zahlawi to stop the choir practices happening at the church. Shadi's reply was as follows, "Dad, if you ask this of Father Zahlawi, I will not return home." He said that and came to church to attend practice and sadly was martyred at the entrance of the church. After that, we lost four other members of our choir from different ages, kids, young men, and women. Despite that, we remained as is. We continued to serve the prayers. We continued to present choir festivals at the Opera House of Damascus and elsewhere in Syria and outside Syria in order to spread the spirit of faith, perseverance, and love among the people. Because what was spilled in Syria was a threat to the structure of the Syrian society. Up until this day, the Joy Choir continues its performances.
Absolutely amazing. Well, I read some of your biography. You published a lot of books, one of which was your biography entitled I Might Have Something to Say, such an amazing title. Part one, which you published in 2014 during the height of aggression against Syria. In the chapter entitled 1974, An Exceptional Year, you wrote about Father Hilarion Capucci, the Syrian Catholic bishop who served as the staunch supporter of Palestine and was, until his passing, harassed by the Zionists wherever he went. He was arrested by the occupation in 1974 while he was trying to smuggle weapons for the resistance in Syria. You said, and I quote what you said, "It is not Israel's fault. It is our fault as Arabs. We get high on words. We numb ourselves while Israel is injecting the Arab brain, which is bound by the knot of guilt towards Jews, with a well-thought-out, intense and organized media. Father Capucci's case was the opportunity of the century, but it was missed." This was written by you in 1975. If back then the Zionist entities' influence in the media was that vast, what can you say about it right now, and what would you have wanted to happen with Father Capucci's case back in the 70s?
Israel تحقن العقل الغربي لا العربي.
Israel influences the Western mentality more than it does with the Arab mentality, which ties a knot of guilt in their conscience. When Father Capucci was arrested, I was hoping for all the Arab leaders, along with the Palestinian leaders and all leaders of the Arab churches, to join forces in an urgent meeting and form committees to study how to present the Palestinian cause for the regional and international public opinion, and allow these committees to tour the world and meet all church leaders of the world, starting with the Pope himself, and then meet with the world's political leaders and political movements to explain to them all why Father Capucci was detained. What we did as Arabs, we used to praise Father Capucci as a hero, calling him a hero at every corner. But other than that, we did nothing. Why? If this were a minor Jewish rabbi who was detained, Israel would have moved the earth for him and pushed public opinion. Why? If this were a minor Jewish rabbi who was detained, Israel would have moved the earth for him and pushed global public opinion to its side. Why do we Arabs get sedated by words? Unfortunately, we remain until this day sedated by words.
What do you think of the influence of Zionists on the media?
The truth is, Zionist media is a very well-organized media ever since this occupation existed. Israel plans for the upcoming 100 years, while we Arabs, we improvise. Even today, our media efforts, even in Syria, are subject to unforgivable improvisation. It is about time in Syria and the Arab world and in the entire East to reconsider the way we deal with the dangers that surround us, the current dangers and the probable future ones. We have no planning strategies. This is what I call for every day.
Well, also in your biography, you published a letter you penned to His Holiness Pope Francis I. In the letter, you thanked the Pope for asking the world to pray for peace for Syria. But if I may, it was a bit of a tough letter because you asked him the following, and I quote what you asked him. You said, "Don't you think that this world also needs the truth? Do you think that if Jesus was in your place right now, would he have stopped at only inviting people to pray? Don't the catastrophes and the atrocities in Syria and the Arab East prompt you, besides calling for prayers, to bring forth more the truth about the region?" First, I wonder if you actually received a reply for this letter, and what prompted you to pen down such a strong-worded letter to the Pope himself?
First of all, I never received any replies to my letters. I have sent hundreds of letters. Second, I blame the Pope in my letters because, for me, he represents Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ never had any considerations for anyone's feelings when it came to the truth. Jesus Christ said, "There is no greater love than that when a person lays down his life for his loved ones." Jesus Christ was the first to give his life for the sake of his love for every human being. Jesus Christ united his own soul with every human being, especially oppressed humans, humans who are deprived, abused, and homeless. Jesus Christ said, "I was hungry, and you fed me. I was a stranger, so you took me in." Today, the West is starving the nations that were once full. They are displacing nations that were once safe. The West is destroying and killing right and left, and not one voice from the Church has arisen to stand firm in the face of the West and ask it, "What are you doing?" Is the role of the Pope only to call upon the people to pray, or rather to be the voice of Jesus? When the papal ambassador in Damascus reprimanded me for that letter and asked me why I was writing these letters, I told him I am only demanding the Pope to speak just as Jesus spoke. I seek nothing more than this. The world today needs to be reminded that humans are sanctified. The sanctity of humans is identical to the sanctity of God. Today, the West slanders everything. Where is the Church from all this?
What other letters did you send that you were hoping to make change and touched your heart, but never received a word or a response from?
I wrote a letter for Archbishop Helder Camara in 1974, right after the Zionist detained Father Hilarion Capucci. At that time, Archbishop Helder Camara was the most famous priest in Latin America. He used to call for the respect of every human being and to respect human rights. Slowly, he became very famous and very influential in Latin America. I wrote a letter to him asking him, "Why are you silent towards the detention of priest of Al-Quds Hilarion Capucci?" Of course, I never received any reply. The problem with the West is whatever touches Israel is blocked. No discussion is allowed there, simply because guilt shackles their feelings and their thoughts in all of the West, whether in the Church or in the society as a whole. Even this priest, who practices a vast degree of liberation, remained silent towards anything linked to Palestine and Father Capucci. So I wrote to him, saying, "Father Capucci is your fellow bishop in the episcopate. Don't ever ask yourself why he was detained. What made him stand firm with his people?" I never received any reply from him.
Sadly and unfortunately. But I want to move to your book entitled War and Peace in Syria. What prompted you to write this book, especially during the time when the entire world was standing against Syria and with only a few friends besides Syria? Didn't this book actually break your tie with the Christians of the West, maybe those who accused President Assad and his government of the scourge that afflicted the Christians in Syria?
I don't care about how people react to my stances. What I care about is to stand with righteousness, to speak the truth out loud and spread this truth the way I see right. Of course, many people blamed me for my stances, one of whom was very close to me. He was a French friend. I distanced myself from him for 6 months. As a result, he began sending me messages through his wife while they both wept, asking for forgiveness. I asked him, "How can you think that I will remain silent about this position of yours while your entire West is destroying my homeland and I watch my people being displaced and becoming refugees?" At the end of the day, they realized the correctness of my position. You can imagine how many situations like this one I had to experience because of my stances.
In chapter 3 of your book, you speak about the Zionist project and why it chose Palestine to invade it and insisted on staying in Palestine. Many Catholic churches and priests accepted this change in Palestine, and many Christians right here in Lebanon accepted that, and they don't even see the Zionist entity as an enemy in the region. You have a chance to talk to them about the Zionist project. How would you convince them that their broken stance, or worse, their indifference about Palestine, is catastrophic and comes with a high price?
I wish upon anyone who hesitates to take a stand against Israel to read a lot of what the Israelis themselves wrote, some of whom have actually left Israel and no longer believe in it. For example, like Israel Shahak, Gilad Atzmon, and many others. But also, I want them to read what was published in the Hebrew journal Kivonim in February 1982, entitled Israel's Strategy in the 1980s, penned by Odi Yinon. Let them read what he wrote. It was a terrifying plan. Yinon announces in this plan Israel's determination to destroy the entire Arab world. Yinon mentions in specific Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Morocco, and many other Arab states. According to Israel's plan, nothing should remain intact in the Arab world. Everything must be destroyed. Let them read. If they had any hopes from Israel's existence, then let them read Israel's plans for them. Then I would call upon them to see what happened in Palestine ever since the decision to partition the country until today. Let them read what many Israelis wrote about the way they implemented this plan and incremental genocide they committed against the Palestinian people. They should also follow up what is happening now in Palestine. If after all that they still have high hopes that Israel holds any good for them, then I fear that they have gone blind.
Well, in Lebanon, there's a big bickering, a big clash between different blocs concerning whether we should still have a resistance or not. Do you think that the resistance in Lebanon should put out its weapons and stop the fight?
Allow me to remind your audience of two specific events. In June 1982, what did the Zionist Occupation Army do in Lebanon? They invaded Beirut and destroyed Lebanon. Since then, resistance was ignited. The second event is July 2006. What would have happened in Lebanon had it not been for the resistance? Would Lebanon have survived until today? I leave it for the audience, whatever their affiliation is, to answer this question.
Well, another firm and truly much appreciated stance of yours, coming from a southern Lebanese Muslim Shia woman like myself, is your firm support to the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, to Hezbollah. Why do you support them? What was the role that you witnessed from them inside of Syria?
In all honesty, I have not been able to meet with fighters from the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah. However, I have met people in Syria whose villages and towns were liberated by Hezbollah. For instance, in Yabrud, many residents in the area told me that Hezbollah fighters were very disciplined, to an astonishing point. They were very respectable and respectful. I wish I had the chance to know from a close distance the effect of Hezbollah's intervention in Syria, but in all honesty, I never had the chance to know that. However, I know what I have heard from the people who had direct contact with them, that they always bowed to them out of respect.
Another stance that you stood, and a lot of people also accused of being biased to Syria, is your stance from the Syrian government and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. What do you tell the people who ask you why you took a stand beside Bashar al-Assad?
President Bashar al-Assad is the legitimate president of Syria. He is responsible for all of Syria. President Assad did not fall upon us from the sky. Neither did the U.S. bring him to us as a puppet president. He was elected by the people and then re-elected again by the Syrian people. The entire world knows that the election results were approved by the Syrian people. When he acquired 74% of the votes, it was more than enough for us to say this man is our president and we will defend him the same way we defend our homeland. Simply because any nation that loses its president will be feared to lose its entirety. As I said it before, I openly say it now. Despite all the suffering that Syria experiences, President Assad has become an icon not only for Syria, but I believe that he became a resistance icon in the entire Arab world. And when I personally think of him, I instantly remember the great leader Jamal Abdel Nasser. I pray for President Assad, and I pray for Syria, and I pray for the Arab world, and I pray for whoever stands in support of Syria, so it may rise again, and with it, the entire Arab world shall rise.
Father Elias Sahlawi, it was a pleasure and an honor to be in your presence right here in the Church of St. Paul Basilica in Harissa in Lebanon. It's always a pleasure to listen to your patriot and your staunch support. We wanted to thank you for everything that you have made, for your entire journey in life. This is a small thank you to Father Elias Zahlawi for your staunch support of the region, especially of Palestine. Thank you very much. It's an honor, sir.
Shukran lakum.
Thank you. I salute the Iranian nation. I salute their victories since 1979 revolution, the point in history which shifted the balance of power towards the peoples of our region after it was in favor of the West. Thank you, and hopefully we see you again soon.
Shukran. Wa ila liqa.
Thank you for joining us in this very special interview. Elias Zahlawi from Lebanon. This is Marwa Osman for the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
A new research paper finds that the U.S. corporate price markups and profits jumped to their highest levels in 7 decades last year. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Study Shows Excess Corporate Profits in the U.S. have become widespread. Here's the story. A A new paper published recently shows that the U.S. corporate price markups and profits surged to their highest levels since 1950s last year, bolstering arguments for an excess profits tax as a way to rein in sky-high inflation. Authored by Mike Kunzel and Nicole Louisiani of the Roosevelt Institute, the analysis finds that markups, the difference between the actual cost of a good or service and the selling price, were both the highest level on record and the largest one-year increase in 2021. Markups this high mean there is room for reversing them with little economic harm and likely societal benefit, Kunzel said in a statement, adding, to tackle inflation, we need an all-of-the-above administrative and legislative approach that includes demand, supply, and market power interventions. In their new brief, Kunzel and Louisiani note that higher markups don't always mean larger profits. But they did in 2021, the researchers write, showing that the net profit margins of U.S. firms jumped from an annual average of 5.5% between 1960 and 1980 to 9.5% in 2021 as companies pushed up prices, citing inflationary pressures across the global economy as their justification. How high companies can increase their sales up and above their cost matters for the economy more generally, because these markups distribute economic gains from workers and consumers to firms and shareholders, said Louisiani, adding, this is especially the case when almost 100% of these firms' earnings derived from markups are distributed upward to shareholders rather than retained and reinvested, making corporations once again price takers rather than price makers, will help bring down prices and in time lead to a more equitable, innovative economy. The new research comes as the White House struggles to formulate a coherent and effective response to an inflation surge that has become a serious economic and political problem, particularly as the pivotal 2022 midterms approach. Survey data shows that U.S. voters, including those in key battleground states, overwhelmingly want the Biden administration to challenge corporate power and support a windfall profit tax to counter soaring prices at grocery stores, gas stations, and elsewhere across the economy. Kunzel and Louisiani's brief makes the case for a new tax combat excess profits that they say have become widespread. Such a tax, the researchers argue, would help redistribute runaway economic gains while simultaneously eroding company incentives to increase their markups. Additionally, they write increasing competition and reducing market power through antitrust action would bring down inflation to some degree, no matter its cause. But influential U.S. economists, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, chief among them, have argued that solving high inflation would require pushing down wages and throwing millions of people out of work. We need 5 years of unemployment above 5% to contain inflation. In other words, we need 2 years of 7.5% unemployment, or 5 years of 6% unemployment, or 1 year of 10% unemployment. Summers, who spoke with President Joe Biden by phone, said in an address in London later that same day. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, who is leading an effort to tamp down inflation by aggressively hiking interest rates, has also cited modest wage increases over the past 2 years as a factor behind rising inflation, expressing his desire to get wages down despite evidence that wage growth has slowed in recent months. Kanzal and Louisiani contend in their paper that while the idea that we are facing the threat of a wage price spiral is becoming conventional wisdom, this brief and other research finds that changes to labor and worker compensation are not driving factors in recent markups. If margins are unusually high, then there is the possibility that profits and markups can decrease as either supply opens up or demand cools, removing pricing pressure, they write, adding, such a high profit margin also means that there is room for wages to increase without necessarily raising prices, an important dynamic in a hot labor market.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A resistance economy and establishing and maintaining relations with independent countries are two axes of Iran's policy. In line with the latter, Iran has signed a 20-year cooperation roadmap with Venezuela during a state visit by its president, Nicolas Maduro, to Tehran to upgrade bilateral relations from tactical to strategic and to expand more into the economic sphere. Reeling under U.S. sanctions but resisting them, in Iran's case with a good measure of success, the two OPEC founding members are determined to draw on their similarities, be those their economic situations and anti-imperialist stance more than anything else. Now, what's so important about boosting ties and how long those ties might last, we'll be hearing from experts on Latin America here on Iran Today with me, Leila Faramarzi. In flipping the proverbial coin, Iran has embraced sanctions as an opportunity. That's what a resistance economy is about. Drawing on domestic potential to resist sanctions and external shocks. Maduro, proud of what he called Venezuela's resistance against sanctions and imperialism since 2017, said his country would like to draw on Iran's experience in the effort. Ms. Elahian is an MP on the Parliamentary National Security and Foreign Policy Committee. She made a trek to Press TV studios to share her views.
Nicolas Maduro's wise policies informed the Venezuelan people of the behind-the-scenes situation and the vicious U.S. acts towards them. Today, the Venezuelan nation is suspicious of the pro-West movements and has isolated them. Venezuela's moving towards stability and economic development.
Press TV's Spanish-language sister channel, Hispan TV, did an interview with the Venezuelan president, during which Maduro praised Iran's help, with Venezuela seriously suffering oil industry. His Tehran visit entailed Iran officially delivering the second of four Aframax oil tankers ordered by Venezuela.
Aframax, built by a state company, is 250 meters long and can carry up to 800,000 barrels of oil. The importance of heightened relations is not just boosting Iranian fuel exports to Venezuela or momentarily helping or receiving help between partners. What really matters is independence, at least oil independence from the U.S. and or U.S. dictates, and setting a trend and example for other countries. Mr. Shahrabi is a writer who specializes in Latin America. He visited us at the studio for an interview. Let's hear him.
And I just mentioned this, that again, it's not only Venezuela. Look at Cuba. Look at Nicaragua. Over there, right there in Venezuela. And there are unions over there, like the ALBA union, including Cuba, Bolivia, Nicaragua. And now with the changes in Latin America, right now that the president of Colombia today was elected, and who has come to power? An ex-rebel. During this last few months, we witnessed the same good news in Peru. We witnessed the changes, the real changes, government changes, governments coming to power who are willing to keep distance from the hegemonic powers of the United States, Europe, and the Honduras, Chile. This happened. This all has happened during the fast. In next few months, we have the election in Brazil. Lula is going to come to power. Then you have this in the Venezuela, in Latin America.
Mr. Sopani is a former diplomat recommended by experts for interviews on Central and South America. And here he is on Skype.
Iran and Venezuela have been amongst the OPEC founding members. The two countries were both colonized by the United States. We achieved independence over 40 years ago, and Venezuela did the same two decades later. These moves for independence and justice prompted the U.S. to impose sanctions on Iran and Venezuela.
Since 2020, Iran has helped repair and overhaul a number of Venezuelan refineries. In May 2020, five tankers from Iran got to deliver gas to Venezuela without much interference, although the U.S. is out to crack down not just on Iranian gas getting to Venezuela, but also on Venezuela's ability to pay in gold, to actually find a market for its gold. Well, between Venezuela and Iran, it's gas for gold and more. The more being pairing up against the common economic and ideological enemy, America, as both states see it.
In this visit of President Maduro, it was mentioned, it was brought up to the attention of the public opinion, that there are 35 million hectares of arable lands in Venezuela, that which out of that, only 10 million hectares is being cultivated at the moment. So there is a possibility to cultivate 25 million hectares of arable land, which has the benefit of four seasons of rain, all the rivers, plenty of water, sun, and everything necessary in order to cultivate every kind of foodstuff. And that at the moment that the food has become a real crisis for the whole world.
Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, but it cannot refine enough oil anymore to satisfy its domestic needs for gasoline, for its transportation sector and consumer uses. It previously relied on refineries operated by Citgo on the U.S. Gulf Coast or other refiners that could handle its heavy crude. But with U.S. sanctions, primary and secondary, Iran's refining capabilities have become critical to Venezuela.
As I said, Venezuela is a very important country in South America. The country has the largest oil reserves in the world, which is estimated to be over 300 billion barrels. Venezuela has also huge gold and aluminium reserves.
What more might the two partners from two almost opposite ends of the globe have found to work with? And what other similarities might they have found in common? Apart from being oil-rich countries sanctioned by the U.S. from two strategic parts of the world, although that is common ground enough if made to last.
Similarities between the two long-term OPEC partners, determined to go on for another 20 years at least, can serve as ground for exactly that. Fortifying a partnership in defiance of the U.S. or construction of either or both of their economies.
We prioritize our neighbors, and Venezuela is considered our political and economic neighbor. If you take a look at Venezuela's position in international organizations, you see that they have always voted in our favor. In the economy, our cooperation with Venezuela proved that geographical distance cannot be a barrier to good economic ties. Our ties with Venezuela have brought hundreds of millions of dollars to the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Be those similarities pretty or not, there's two views of them. One view finds similarity between the two countries in that they both have huge oil reserves. Venezuela with about 300 billion barrels and Iran with about 160. Both countries have hard-up economies and high inflation. Well, that's relative, as while Iran's inflation hovers around 50 and 60%, Venezuela's inflation rate peaked and was running at around 1,200% in 2021, according to its own central bank.
UN Special Rapporteur Elena Duhan has visited Iran and Venezuela. She investigated the effects of the United States' cruel sanctions on the ordinary people in both Iran and Venezuela. Duhan said in her statement that some civilians in Iran died due to lack of medicine and medical equipment. The same has happened in Venezuela. Their health system is aging, they do not have enough medical equipment, and they are under strict sanctions. Due to U.S. sanctions and crazy skyrocketing inflation rates in Venezuela, its people can't afford to have a decent healthcare system.
Despite Iran's help with drilling its oil, Venezuela's oil production has remained well below 1 million barrels a day at discounted prices. This is so that customers will take a risk of America's wrath for dealing with Venezuela. And so the Latin American country is suffering a serious lack of hard currency. Iran's output, limited by OPEC quotas, has recently stood at 2 and 2.5 million barrels per day. Iran, like I said, has been looking to countries resisting U.S. sanctions as well as to the East. And so it has been exporting oil to China at an acceptable volume.
The two sides must focus on political and international cooperation. I believe that as long as a leftist government is ruling Venezuela, there is hope for these cooperations to continue.
Looking at Venezuela, while that country had over $40 billion in reserves as recently as 12 years ago, those are now down to about $6 billion. It used to generate $90 billion from its oil exports. Now it's generating only $3 or $4 billion. U.S. sanctions have meant that Venezuela can't refinance any of its debt, and it's had to find ways to get its affairs in order, like selling gold, which Venezuela is rich in.
The Venezuelan people and President Maduro are very suspicious of the U.S. policies because Washington has imposed very harsh sanctions on Venezuela over the past years. Washington also provoked social unrest and internal chaos in Venezuela.
As for the positive similarities, in February this year, the Venezuelan ambassador to Tehran, Carlos Antonio Alcala Cordones, underlined the need for the formation of a bloc. A bloc against U.S. hegemony and imperialism, obviously, that would consist of Russia and China, as well as Iran and Venezuela. And there it is. The ambassador was banking on ideological similarities and loyalty to friendship and fellow humans. He also hailed Iran's having sent ships carrying fuel, food and other products to Venezuela at a critical time, as well as this country's opening of Magas's chain stores and pharmacies in Venezuela. Although further investment by Iranians would require more than goodwill and political MOUs, according to our show guest, whose office we visited. His office was covered in memorabilia from Stay in the Americas. Mr. Tafreshi is a Latin American affairs analyst. He has lived in Venezuela for 10 years and shared his experience on the ground with us.
It seems that completing the project of political cooperation and economic development is not an easy task, because the party to this contract is Iran, which is under economic sanctions itself. Iran cannot sell its own oil and collect money freely. Therefore, it faces restrictions in investing in offshore projects. These are important issues. So in this situation, we have to focus on providing technical assistance and consultations as a restarting point in our cooperation with Venezuela.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.